It was such an honor to have Ernest Stevens on the show. He's a retired police officer, and he's the main subject behind the Emmy Award-winning HBO documentary, Ernie and Joe, Crisis Cops. Ernest Stevens, next on the CJ Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the CJ Evolution podcast. Patrick here. We know you have many options, but thank you for tuning in to the show. Big shout out to all the brave men and women working in the criminal justice field, wherever you're at, whatever you were doing. Thank you for doing it. And remember this, you are honored, cherished, and above all, you are loved. Keep up the fantastic work and be safe. If you are suffering, remember this, you are not alone. You are never alone. Shatterproof employs evidence-based therapies, innovative medical care, and a comprehensive wellness program which focuses on symptoms of PTSD in order to guide our first responders on the right path to achieving lifelong recovery from drugs and alcohol. The Shatterproof program is designed to help first responders overcome specific obstacles and to increase their ability to manage emotions during stressful situations without turning to self-medication. Our medical team works to customize a care plan tailored to underlying issues that contribute to substance use disorders. Our evidence-based holistic treatment approaches addresses every individual's physical, neurological, mental, social, emotional, and spiritual well-being. Folks, if you are suffering, and I know a lot of you are, or you know somebody, another first responder who is suffering, please reach out. I am a national outreach liaison for the program, and I am a huge believer in it because I went through it, and I am better for it. Please reach out to me today, 303-960-9819. That's 303-960-9819 or 866-768-9792. Take that step forward and let the amazing team at FHE Health help you today. Hello, everybody. I am very excited to have my next guest on the show. Ernest Ernie Stevens is on the show. He spent 28 years in law enforcement, and you might have seen him on the Emmy-nominated, award-winning documentary, Ernie and Joe, Crisis Cops. And Ernie is here today. Welcome, brother. Thank you for being here. I know you're busy.
I appreciate it, my friend. I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Well, and I forgot to mention that you're a best-selling author.
So you can that happened too, man.
You're doing so much for the profession, brother, and for the listeners out there, you really got to follow Ernie Stevens and check out the show on HBO. It's still running. I know you're in some developmental stuff right now with some new stuff coming out, brother. But I always like asking Leos or veterans that come on the show a very simple question, Ernie. And why did you get into law enforcement? What was the catalyst?
So for me, unlike many today, it was something from a very young age. I gravitated towards it, which made no sense. My parents owned a restaurant. Their parents owned a restaurant. Me and my brother worked at the restaurant growing up. But I don't know if it was like being a patrol in the fifth grade when I had my little orange belt and that little badge that did it for me or what. But it seemed like whatever job I was working at growing up, there was always like a police officer there off duty working.
Yeah.
And I would just bug that officer asking questions and it felt like the right thing to do. And the hardest part about it was just telling my parents, hey, can my brother like take over and can I go this direction? And they were super supportive. So yes, from a very young age.
Again, thank you for your service. And that's huge. You know, when you're the closest people around you support you. So many things going on in law enforcement now, Ernie. We were talking a little bit before we started. Law enforcement officers are leaving the profession, it seems like, in droves. Why do you think that's the case, brother? I mean, I'm sure there's various things, but if you can nail it down a little bit, the reasons why officers are getting out of the profession.
Yeah, that's a difficult one because so much has transpired in the last just 24 months. You know, law enforcement to me always will be and always has been a very noble profession. Mm-hmm. And not by our own fault, sometimes that nobility has been stripped away from the badge, right? By some of the things that you've seen in the media, and then the result of how the community reacts to it. And then we have to find a way to bring that nobility back to the badge by bridging the gaps with communities and, you know, trying to reestablish these connections. So when you don't feel appreciated, you know, in your line of work, it's very easy to say, if I'm not appreciated here, then I need to go find somewhere else to be. And I think a lot of law enforcement officers that left way before retirement age, just talking to them, that's what they felt is I'm going to work. I'm not appreciated, whether it's internally through command staff or just in the community. Things have changed.
Yeah. Well, I always say, and maybe I'm just naive, Ernie, I don't know what your take is, but I think the vast majority of people out there support law enforcement. I don't think they're as vocal, maybe, sometimes as they should be. And I understand the reasons why. But, you know, and I'm speaking to the choir and the listeners probably know, I mean, we only see what a percentage, a 10% or whatever the percentage is of the population when we go out there and get on the street. That's not reflective of the whole population. And it took me a long time to realize most people are good. It's just we deal with that very small percentage that gets us, not everybody, but I can speak for myself. You know, I became jaded, cynical, pissed off half the time. But I think a lot of people, most people support law enforcement. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I've met so many wonderful people, whether I'm traveling or whether I'm here at home, that really do support you. It can be something as simple as you're in the drive-thru and the person in front of you saw that there was a police car behind him and paid for your coffee or snack or whatever. Finding notes on the car, just those little things. It means a lot. It always seems like, Patrick, when you're having those worst days, something like that shows up and it reminds you why you joined the profession. That was to give back to the community that you promised to protect and serve. And they do give back, and they give back a lot. And sometimes we just don't see it.
I
was going to say one of the ones that just brings me to tears is, you know, anytime there's a police officer that's killed here in San Antonio or a firefighter, and we're in that long line driving out, you know, to the cemetery to see all the community members parked along the side of the road with their hand over their heart, or they're holding a flag, or they're saluting. And these are community members I've never met before in my life that I know of, yet they've taken the time to stop and participate in something that holds a lot of honor to us. And that's to bury another officer. So I see it and it brings me to tears every time.
Yeah, that's very, very somber and very sad. Now, I want to pivot a little bit, Ernie, about how you got involved with, Emmy Award-winning show, Ernie and Joe, Crisis Cops. So how did that get started? Because it's amazing if I could go down that rabbit hole a little bit, because it's an amazing show. I've watched it. You're out there, you're doing what you're doing. I mean, how did that come to fruition, if you don't mind?
Well, first of all, it's just being in the right place at the right time. But short story long, we'll just drag it for a little bit. I was actually in the gang unit on San Antonio in a tactical response unit, and I got signed up on my day off to attend this CIT training that I'd never heard of back in 2000. Back in 2003, in Houston Police Department had to come down here and put it on because we'd never heard of it.
Yeah.
And when I got back to work and they're like, "Hey, you're going to CIT training." I'm like, "Okay, what is it? Crisis intervention." I'm like, "That sounds cool. Like, who's putting this on? Is it the FBI? Is this, a terrorist thing?" And they're like, "Not quite, man. You're gonna learn about mental illness and how to de-escalate people in a mental health crisis." And I was like, whoa, take me out, scratch my name. I'm not that guy. One, because I'm very ignorant to what mental health was.
Yeah.
They just didn't teach it in the academy. And I just didn't have any personal experience with it growing up. So I was probably as uneducated as a lot of the population is if you just don't know about mental health. But it was too late to get my name off the list. So I went to the training, and I knew while I was there, like, we're going to have a mental health unit. We're the seventh largest city. I am bought in, sold out 100%. I love this. Goodbye, gang unit. Hello, mental health. It was just trying to sell the chief on the idea of allowing that to happen. But once it did happen, we're a very small unit, just two people, in a 2,700 police department, a personnel police department. And it was like, we're partnered together and we have to answer every single mental health call in the city. You get over 1.2 million calls a year. Like, wow. I don't know how we're going to do this. Right. But with that came a little local media, which then spawned into a national story on the, from the Atlantic, written by Ann Snyder. She titled the article, Policing with Velvet Gloves. I thought was, man, that's pretty catchy. And it kind of talked about her ride along with us. And she's like, these guys are kind of like social workers, but they got a gun, yet they sit down with people. It's strange. And so she wrote this story. The story went to ABC News and Byron Pitts from Nightline came out and did a ride along. And that ride went extremely well. We ended up, you know, kicking in a door and doing CPR on a lady and saving her life. I mean, it was just wild. Yeah. And so Ann Snyder, the original writer from The Atlantic, was friends with the actual director that would end up directing Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops, and reached out to her and said, hey, there's two guys, there's these two dummies down in Texas. I don't know.
Doing great things.
Yeah, yeah. They wear blue jeans and t-shirts, yet they drive an unmarked car, but somehow they're cops and you got to go see it for yourself. So I get a phone call one day from Jen McShane, and she introduces herself as a filmmaker from up in New York, and wants to come down and do a ride along. I was thinking about doing a documentary, and I'm like, sure, come on down. So the day she arrives, you know, we're prepping, expecting, you know, a decent little entourage. There was no cinematography and there was no sound person. Like, I'm like, what's going on here? And she's following us around with a cell phone. And I'm like, dude, like, what kind of B film is this? Like, little did I know, like, she's brilliant. Like, she's done documentaries. I should have done a little bit more homework because I'm an idiot, but she's very well established, has a mind that is just brilliant, and she didn't want to feel too intrusive. She wanted to give us our space and just almost act as if she was not there. And with it, she said within the first 2 hours she knew that there's going to be a story here.
Wow.
And I knew what call it was. There was an individual that was in crisis at a group home, and he was having homicidal thoughts that he wanted to stab and kill the group home manager. So we're talking to him, you know, we de-escalate him and said, look, I think that you would benefit from some treatment. Would you like to go voluntarily with us? You know, we'll stay with you until you feel safe. And I think it'd be the best thing for you. He agreed. But then on the way to the car, he's like, well, I'm not going to ride in a police car, even though it's unmarked. He goes, I'll go if I can ride up front. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. You can ride up front. I'll jump in the back. You know, so we clear him real quick. And as I'm getting ready to jump in the back, Jen kind of grabs me and pulls me back and goes, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm getting in the car. Like, what are you doing? Like, I thought it was a trick question. I'm like, what is? And she goes, you're going to let him ride up front with Joe? And I'm like, well, yeah. She goes, you're going to ride behind him in a cage? I'm like, yeah. She goes, what happens if he attacks Joe? I'm like, well, that's Joe's problem, right?
Like, Joe's got a gun.
Yeah, I'm like, I was safe, but... I mean, in all fairness, it's like we're just taking him to get some help. Yeah. He's not in trouble. He's not
under arrest. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's. And she's like, okay, this would have never happened in New York. Like, I'll be back. And she did. She came back for 3 years filming the documentary.
Yeah. That's amazing. And, you know, I think it made me think of the old days. You remember Ernie, ask, tell, take, or however you want to phrase it. You know, and I think those days are, I mean, they're still here. I mean, they're in some situations, but. It amazes me when I got into the profession. I mean, we didn't go on a lot of, I was in a smaller agency for my career, two of them, but we didn't go on a lot of people in crisis, mental health crisis calls. Now it seems like I still have a lot of friends that are on the job. I mean, they're going to them all the time, all the time. And I can't imagine a place like Houston. I mean, like you said, what, a call load or annual calls of what, a million?
Yeah, and about 22,000 documented mental health calls. And that's a very conservative number, right? I mean, we had to, because, you know, they can come in as a welfare check, a disturbance, suicide in progress, mental health. I mean, they can come in as anything and then manifest into a mental health crisis when you're on scene or on location.
Mm-hmm.
So the training was invaluable. It was something that I knew once I finished the training that I was just scratching the surface. And I needed to know a lot more. So I joined the National Alliance for Mental Illness, was a board member there for years, and really had just take in everything and get a feel for the community in a way that I've never done before. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it was always police officer in a uniform, go out, enforce laws. And this was different, right? Because this is the civil side of the law, where we really need to know what we're doing. And I didn't. So they paired us with our local mental health authority and let us let a clinician ride with us. And I had to learn to speak the language of mental health. I didn't understand it. And they didn't understand law enforcement talk because we've been so siloed for so long and we didn't know how to work together. So we had to establish these relationships and really learn how to be on the same page and find out what do you do well, what can we do, and then let's meet in the middle and provide the best service possible. Yeah. So there was a lot that we had to do before we really got rolling.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as officers, Ernie, I mean, you talked to a lot of agencies. We mentioned an agency you went out to and spoke. I always tell cops, and I don't know what your thought is. I mean, I don't care how tough you think you are. I mean, all this stuff. I came out of the military and, you know, and I thought, oh, yeah, yeah. This job will get to you at some point. It will get to you. I mean, it'll affect you. It did me. It probably did you and other people. I'm assuming it did you. But what do you tell officers when you go out and do training, how to deal or how to mitigate the mental anguish that a lot of them go through? Because I always tell cops, you know, okay, the hypervigilance, all that stuff. And you correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you have to be able to put that to the side, what you just saw, to go to the next call, because that's going to keep you alive. The problem I had is bringing it home and lamenting on it and stewing on it, rumination, and things like that. So when you go out and you talk to agencies, because you're all over the place, what are some of the pieces of advice that you give officers?
Well, first I talked to leadership. And, you know, I look at the way that we recruit officers, right? Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, it was cops, right? We were watching cops on TV.
Yeah.
Oh, man, the theme song was sexy. Everything about it was sexy, right? It
wasn't any paperwork. It was just driving fast, taking indoors. That's it.
Lethal weapon, man. Lethal weapon. So, and then, you know, this generation had Life PD, right?
Yeah.
So if you look at any recruiting pamphlet, I can imagine, just Google one and bring it up. What pictures are they showing, right? I'm assuming it's an officer holding a canine, maybe an officer on a motorcycle,
tactical vehicle, Denver,
tactical vehicle, helicopter, right? All that. And we're saying, hey, look, come and be a part of the 1% that only a fraction of officers can come do. Or should we be realistic with the officers and say, hey, in this pamphlet, you're going to see an officer with his arm around another officer who's got their head down saying, hey, man, I'm sorry you had to see that or go through that. I'm going to let you know you're not alone and we're going to get through this. Let them know from rookie to retirement that we're going to have an organization that's going to support you because you are going to see an incredible amount of traumatic events take place in front of you. And it's going to shock your conscience. And whether you have good coping skills, whether you're a very resilient person, or you practice wellness and mindfulness, it doesn't matter. This is slowly going to chip away, and you've got to be prepared for that. So I try to tell them, look, leadership, have some things in place to help them. And then I tell the officers, look, in the academy, I'm assuming you have heard you're not a real policeman until you've been, divorced, in a shooting, and sued, right? That's what you always hear. And I tell them, man, that's crap.
That's BS.
Whoever's told you that, throw that in the trash and let's talk real for a minute. And then I ask even the seasoned officers, how do we judge today once we retire a successful career? What do you think most officers say?
They do 30 years. What's that?
They do 30 years. How do they judge that they were successful?
They survived.
That's it. That's it, Patrick. I made it. Yeah, you made it, but why aren't we setting the bar higher? Yeah, you made it and had two divorces, paid $3,000 in child support, was suspended 5 times. Like, what footprint did you actually leave in the community? What did you do to make it a better place? Why are we setting the bar so low in law enforcement where all we have to do is survive?
Yeah.
It blows my mind that is still the answer I get no matter where I ask. And it's like, we've got to do better, and we're doing it to ourselves. So it's a long conversation, the question you asked, but there's so many points that you can reach no matter where they are, whether they're thinking about joining, they're in the academy, or they've been on 30 years. There's so much in between that we can talk about to set them up for success post hanging the badge up.
Well, and I think, like you said, I think you're talking about culture. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, part of it's culture of an organization, every organization, we all may be cops, but as you know, Ernie, every organization has its different culture. And that's what I like about certain leaders in certain departments, like we mentioned before. They're kind of taking the lead in this, as they should, and they're kind of leading from the top down, and they're trying to change that culture within a police organization. And I really like what you said, Ernie, about, you know, marketing, for lack of a better word, and really showing the true side of a law enforcement officer. And I like what you said about, okay, having an officer kind of comfort another officer, because that's the reality. But I don't know why we're so hesitant. I shouldn't paint a broad brush, but a lot of organizations are still hesitant to do that. Are they just afraid that, you know, they're going to scare people off if they're telling the truth?
You know? It could be, or they have to admit they're lacking something within their own organization.
Yeah.
Right? If officers are coming to the forefront and saying, hey, I'm struggling, then leadership can either embrace that and say, what can we do to help you? Or, okay, if you're struggling, you need to go get some help, or maybe just leave, because we don't have time for that. We need to be able to put an officer in that car that can respond to calls the minute they show up to work, and we don't have time for your weakness.
Yeah.
Because that line of thought is still out there, especially in smaller agencies where it's the good old boys system.
Sure.
And that's just the way things have always been done. And it's just not fair, because the officers who have families of their own, they have to go home to that. If they're not their best coming to work, how are they supposed to be at their best to serve the community?
Yeah.
So we've got to do a better job internally to provide the services that the community is counting us for.
Yeah. And I always tell people, Ernie, or when they ask for advice, align yourself with the officers that are not living in a bubble and everything's rosy and sunshine, but the officers who can be more positive and more uplifting. You know what I mean? Being around officers, because we all know, and it's agencies, every agency, you know, there's cops that are extremely negative and cynical. And then there's other officers who are more outgoing, who are more positive. And I always tell officers when they ask me, or new officers, you know, to try to align yourself with those type of officers. Because I really do think, and that doesn't solve all the problem, but it helps. And then get friends outside of law enforcement. That was the best thing I ever did in my career. That's not a knock on law enforcement or anything like that. I love the profession and the brave men and women who serve, but getting friends outside of law enforcement helped me tremendously. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, no, for sure. Other than Joe, you know, as you see during the filming, I mean, we were always together.
Yeah.
Even once we got off duty, we usually signed up for overtime working together.
Yeah.
And if we didn't have an extra job that night, we would go eat dinner together. But
yeah,
outside of him, I mean, me and my family here, we had close ties to the church.
Yeah.
And nobody in the church, other than maybe two people, were law enforcement. And I didn't really see them or interact with them a whole lot. So it was, you know, retired people from the Marine Corps, people in communications, all different walks of life. And I got to experience that, listen to them and learn. And because I love to learn about people, right? I love to listen to lived experience, and you definitely have to have that, right? Because
yeah,
you learn, what do you do to relax? And so, you know, it's amazing, because we're not siloed in law enforcement. We are a culture within a culture in law enforcement. And it's usually, oh, well, man, I go home and I drink every night until I get tired and I go to bed, because that's how I deal with it, because I got to put up with the same old tomorrow, which is mean people or traffic accidents and all this stuff, where other people don't have to see that. They're like, oh, I just need to be able to relax a little bit, listen to music, take a cooking class, and then have another day of who knows what tomorrow. So it is, you definitely nailed it, you know, having people outside the department.
Yeah, I just think you get kind of a myopic view of the world. And that was my problem for many years, is, you know, I didn't want to associate with anybody, because that was the culture. I think still is in a lot of organizations. I don't want to associate, you know, if I can run you first, get your date of birth and everything, and you're fine, I'll hang out with you. But and then I started breaching out and, you know, getting friends outside law enforcement. I just think it's a great thing to do. And that's, and I know for the people out there, what about my officer safety and letting my guard down? It's not about that, but it's about learning about other people I think that goes towards maybe a healthier mental state when you realize that not everybody out there is a criminal.
And so you bring up something, and I get knocked on it every time I say it, and I don't care. I'd say it anyway. But, you know, for many, many years, I lived not paranoid or super vigilant, but, you know, I was always the guy, okay, when we eat, we gotta eat.
Oh, I was too. Area,
right? And then just maybe 5 years ago, it finally came to the point where I'm going to sit to my back to the door tonight, and I'm going to listen to what my wife has to say tonight instead of always looking over her shoulder at people that are walking by, checking belt line. I mean, just doing the ridiculousness that I would do for years and years and never be able to really fully engage with her, right? Which was a complete ripoff to our marriage for years.
Yeah.
But also, it just kept me in a heightened state all the time that over time becomes very toxic.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And like you said, I mean, you're not paying attention. The stress is up here. That hypervigilant state, like I think Gil Martin talks about all the time. You know, he talks about being up here all the time, and firefighters have it made. I think, you know, they go out and they come back and they have a difficult job. But what advice, Ernie, I'm sure you get this a lot. What advice would you give a young or a person, young person that was contemplating a career in law enforcement?
I'll never knock the profession itself, but I would say definitely you need to be prepared to set yourself up for success financially, because you may be making more money than you've ever made before. It depends on where you go to work. Not that you're going to get rich, but so many young officers I see go out and then buy these brand new jacked up Chevy trucks or Ford trucks and pulling boats behind them. I'm like, my God, man, what are you doing? You know,
the overtime. So,
yeah, the Amazon truck every 3 hours, like, God bless, man. So one, really get your finances in order very early.
Very
on.
Good advice.
You know, and have some type of deferred compensation account set up with whoever, whether it's within your agency or outside that. Number two, always put your marriage, if you're married, a priority. This profession, really, I would love to know the stats, but I'm sure they are one of the leading professions that has a divorce rate that is extremely high. And that's just so damaging all the way down the line. So because you're going to be chasing, you're going to be an adrenaline junkie at work. You can't help it because the way the calls come out. And then when you get home, you're still going to want that adrenaline. If you don't seem like you have it, then you start looking other places to find it. And that's where these problems happen, whether it's through a porn addiction or an affair or whatever, right? I've seen it. And it's sad. I would definitely say set yourself up with, so what I do, and I use this acronym GEBY, G-E-B-Y. Each morning on my phone, I have an app for gratitude. Stands for gratitude. So I click on it. I name three things that I'm grateful for and why. Not just I'm grateful for my wife, but why am I grateful for her that day? Like, what happened, right? Mm-hmm. So three things I'm grateful for and why. The E stands for exercise, which is maybe just 20, 30 minutes, get moving each day. The B stands for breakfast or something nutritional, right? Because cops have just the worst nutrition, right? You check in service and boom, you're hitting the first burger joint in the drive-thru because you didn't have time to eat. Yeah. You barely woke up, you know. And then the Y, I think, is most important, Patrick. The Y stands for you.
Yeah.
Each day, carve out some time and do something just for you. Family time is important, but also that me time, you have to be a little bit selfish and find that 20, 30 minutes to do something for you, whether it's reading a book, watching a movie, just unplugging from social media, whatever you got to do, go for a walk, listen to the birds, man, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Right. So I tell them, you know, if you can start these things out early in your career and stick to this regimen, you'll find that each morning you're waking up and you're not looking at the news, which is doom and gloom.
Oh, yeah.
You're putting yourself in a positive mindset.
Yeah.
In a growth mindset of, wow, what can happen next, right? You've exercised, right? Heart risk is one of the worst things for law enforcement. You're eating something nutritional. So cook the night before, have your meals planned out, and then carve out time for you. I think it's just so important that we overlook that because we're helpers and we're always worried about other people. And we're the last ones to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I love how you started out with gratitude. You know, I mean, that whole mindfulness. I mean, I practice gratitude every day, brother. I mean, I get up and first of all, I thank God, or for the listener, whatever you believe in, higher power, whatever. I thank God I'm alive. You know, I start with, you know, that I have a roof over my head, that I'm healthy. It really does work for the listener out there that thinks it's, you know, hoity-toity or whatever. No, it works. And then your mind shift, or your mind begins to gravitate towards being grateful. Not that you're not going to have bad days, but I love gratitude practices. And I encourage people to start every day. Like you said, you don't have to sit there with your legs crossed, and but just be grateful. You know, be grateful for your life, for what you have in your life. Yeah, you might be going through some crap, but you always have something to be grateful for. And I really love what you said about taking time for you. I learned a while ago is you have to be extremely selfish, not a narcissist and ignoring other people, but selfish when it comes to your mental health and your emotional well-being, because nobody's going to come in and help you with that. You got to do it yourself, right?
Yeah. And so that comes with sacrifice, right?
Yeah.
I love working out. That's just one of my ways I cope with stress for the day. And I've always tried to do it when I get off work. I come home, try to work out. It just never can happen, right?
Sure.
The phone never stops. Oh, answer this email real quick. Oh, a text from the boss. I got to get this. So now I have to sacrifice. I get up at 4 a.m., right? Practice my gratitude. I do a Bible study with a group of guys online in the morning.
Yeah.
I'm the first one to send it out at that hour. They're like, dude, every morning at 4:30, we're here. You hear our phones go ding and we know it's you. And I'm like, hey man, silence your phone. I don't know what to tell you. And then I'm at the gym by 5 a.m. because nobody's going to call me from 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. And if they do, I'm not going to know because I throw my phone in my bag and I don't look at it.
Yeah.
So it comes with sacrifice, but it's a sacrifice that for me, it is needed throughout the day. It gets my mind prepared for the day. I try not to focus on what's waiting for me at work. I just focus on my workout. I look at people. I'm like, man, look at that lady. She's about 80 years old on that treadmill and she's getting it.
It's inspiring.
And this person's over here. Looks like they're getting ready to do a bodybuilding show. And this couple, I love that they're smiling and laughing with each other. And just being in the gym and getting my own thing done and looking at the enjoyment that other people are there, it feels good inside.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I love it what you said. And I'm the same way. I want to be disconnected when I go work out. And it amazes me. You kind of walk, you know, you're surveying the gym and you see all these people on their phones. And I want to go up to people and say, hey, you can use that machine, because if you're on your Twitter feed, can you get up?
Well, see, it's mindset. I'm hoping they're looking at a workout routine going, what's my next exercise? See, quit being so negative, Patrick.
I love it, brother. Now, on a serious note, I mean, a lot of listeners out there, maybe you're a first responder, maybe you're doing something within criminal justice. So Ernie, if people are out there suffering right now, and there'll be some resources in the show notes, what advice would you give them? Because it is so difficult, as you know, for first responders to take that first step forward. And I could speak from experience, taking that first step forward. That's the biggest step. And a lot of first responders don't do that, unfortunately. What advice would you give to the listener out there, brother, who are suffering right now?
Take your mask off.
Yeah, I like that.
Take it off, man. Quit hiding. You don't need to be strong. You don't need to feel weak asking for help. There are people that will love you and that will miss you and that will hurt until the day that they die. If you leave this earth by means of suicide, take your mask off. Let somebody see you and not the problem that you think you're facing on a daily basis. Let them see you so they can make a connection with you. And I promise you, there will be help for you. I promise you. Take your mask off.
Thank you, brother. And Ernie, if people want to check you out, I'm sure you're all over. I know you're all over social media. What's the easiest way to find you, brother, besides HBO?
Subscribe. Take your 7-day free trial and then cancel it so you don't have to pay that monthly dues. But if you haven't seen it, check it out. I'm on Twitter, eSteven0845. You'll never guess what my badge number was. So that's easy. I'm on LinkedIn and then ErnestStevens.com all together. ErnestStevens.com with a V, and that'll take you to a website that you can send me a message as well. So I would love to, you know, continue to connect with people that I've never met before, reconnect with people that I've, you know, somehow became unplugged from in the past, and continue the conversation of just mental health and how are you and your family doing, and how can we stay positive together?
Yeah. Ernie Stevens, thank you, brother. I appreciate it. I appreciate the work you do. Much success to you in the future. Anything we can do for you, please reach out to me, sir. Everything we talked about will be linked up in the show notes. Thank you, Ernie.
My pleasure. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.